It is Sunday, August 25th, 2013, and this is episode 32 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. Joining me tonight as my co-host is Andrew Callett. Would say hi, Andy.
Good evening, Jerry, and kind listeners.
As usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not reflect those of our employers. So the first story tonight is a fairly minor story, but I say it has pretty major ramifications. McAfee has essentially expressed an apology for a report they put out back in 2009 where they cited cyber losses of $1 trillion. And, you know, the interesting thing here, to me at least, is it pays to be a little skeptical about the numbers that some of these security companies, consultancies, whatnot, throw out, because, you know, behind each one of these reports is a bit of an agenda. And to me, the unfortunate thing about this particular report is it was used as the impetus for a lot of legislation. You know, even President Obama got up, I think, in the State of the Union address and quoted this report. And, you know, as it turns out, it apparently was built on a bunch of crap.
But what about the children, Jerry? Who's thinking of the children?
Well, the pedophiles. Moving on.
I'm stunned that a security vendor would in any way possibly have a conflict of interest in estimating the size of the problem they're trying to fix.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's an important lesson, is to be somewhat cynical about these reports. I mean, honestly, I think there are some good data that's put forth in some of these, but, you know, when you get a number like $1 trillion, you have to wonder what the motivation and means behind creating that is.
You know, good on you know, this guy from McAfee to, you know, kind of come out and say, hey, our bad. It is, you know, it's surprising to see them sort of backtrack a little bit there. But I think, you know, it helps their credibility in that respect. But
I have to tell you, I'm totally shocked to see that.
I'm sure their sales force is probably frowning a little. Because all their ROI calculators just had to change.
That's right. Update the spreadsheets.
That's right. But, you know, they do make a kind of a good point, you know, later in here, where they kind of talk about the intrinsic value versus the extrinsic value of things. And, you know, talking about especially with corporate assets and intellectual property, you know, how do you value it is an interesting question, and what it means to you versus somebody else. And
exactly,
you know, it's it is an interesting challenge. But as we get more, I guess, actuarial in our approach to information security spend, these sorts of numbers are important, but it also shows how difficult it is to really nail this down.
Yes. And actually, that kind of dovetails nicely into the next story I had, which was how the Snowden effect is paralyzing CIOs. And one of the interesting things about this is when you read the article, and it's from Network World, when you read the article, you know, it doesn't directly say it, but it insinuates that any kind of loss or risk is unacceptable. And so, you know, they're citing CIOs as rolling back their, at least one CIO, rolling back their BYOD program because it's too risky. And, you know, I think that really ignores the fact that as a business, you take risk all the time, and security isn't fundamentally different than any other risk. And so that actually plays through in another story. We'll talk a little bit about CISOs, but
hey, nice tease.
I know, I'm getting good at this.
Yeah. So, we're prepping for commercial breaks. And after the break, we'll talk about why your children are secretly trying to kill you.
No. All right.
Sorry. No, go on. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, I had made a couple of notes on this. And, you know, I guess
what is the Snowden effect? Let's talk about that. Snowden effect?
Well, you know, I had a really tough time actually divining what the Snowden effect was. There's a couple of possibilities. And number one, in my mind, is the Snowden effect is this big influx of what they call millennials into the workforce who have, who rate themselves as being highly adept with computers. And, you know, that creates some natural problems with erecting barriers, you know, to protect your data, because now these people have, you know, higher than average ability to work the system. And, you know, my take on that is you're not necessarily trying to defend against a determined insider. You know, if you have someone who is a system administrator of yours and they're hell-bent on disclosing some of your data, I don't know there's a lot that you can do, right?
Well, there may be things you could do, but it could be so costly or slow, so such a cost to production and efficiency that it doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a government where you would rather burn the building down and kill all the people inside of it, then have your data disclosed. Yeah, I guess you can justify quite a lot, but if you're making staplers.
But let's examine that statement for a moment, because, you know, part of what this article is saying is that, well, if the NSA couldn't protect their data, how can I possibly, as a widget manufacturer, protect my data?
Right.
Well, here is kind of my thoughts on that. In my, you know, many years of interacting with many, many different organizations, what I have found as a general rule is the larger the organization, the worse they are at IT security, because they're so big, they're so spread out, they're so diversified. They just have all these legacy concepts of business that makes it usually a medium-sized business has the resources and the size that they can get a handle on things. Small businesses are in trouble and big businesses are in trouble. The medium-sized business seem to be at the sweet spot where they can actually deploy technology effectively enough to actually combat some of these things. So when they say if the NSA can't do it, nobody can, I actually think that that's not true. I think the NSA probably has a tremendously bad record. I shouldn't just pick on the NSA. I would say any large government agency has a terrible time securing because of their size and the way things are done in government. And sure, military and NSA type, you know, pseudo-military organizations have a much better sort of mindset, but I still think that they don't have the sophisticated level of controls that we are assuming they have. And I think that they're probably more audit-based, not necessarily control-based, because even now they're saying they don't even know all the documents that Snowden took, when he took them, how they took them. So that tells me that I don't think Snowden was any sort of elite hacksaw. I don't think he was Neo, right? I just think, you know, he found a way to just copy documents because there wasn't much controls in place.
My guess, he had administrator rights on a Windows file server.
Yeah, probably.
You know, in this article, they talk about how they're pretty sure that he social engineered his way onto other people's computers. And, you know, we may never really know, but I would like to think that the average NSA person wouldn't let some other NSA person walk up and monkey with their computer.
You know, certainly we're speculating here, and let's be clear on that. But I got to think that if he was doing anything relatively advanced, it would have raised more flags.
Exactly.
you know, just in general, right? The risk level goes up that he's going to get caught there. Again, we are speculating, but my take on it is really large organizations have a really hard time securing their data. And so, you know, because of just the nature of their business, of their organization. And, you know, in this case, I think what it really points out more than anything is that this isn't, you know, the Snowden effect shouldn't, you know, stop CIOs from trying to do what they're trying to do, right? It still comes back to the basic blocking and tackling, understanding your data, understanding your value, understanding where it's at, understanding what the likely threats are going to be, and then finding, you know, those sweet spots of cost of what you're going to mitigate the risk around the things that matter the most to your organization, you know? And that is a unique individual proposition to every company and every organization.
Very well said.
Well, I'm for those who are wondering why I don't sound as up today, I had a very long, busy weekend doing great fun stuff, but every muscle in my body is sore and I'm burnt and bruised. So I'm kind of feeling a little beat up today. So,
don't ask him what he was doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's all legal. No bunnies were harmed. But anyway, my point is, I think this is a false measure to look at something like the NSA having a disclosure like this against your own organization. I don't think this is an apples to apples comparison.
I agree, especially with the content of what was taken. And you know, again, you know, whether you're, you know, in some interesting defense area, or, you know, you've got credit card numbers, if you have somebody who's very, very determined, and they're an insider, right? It becomes very, very difficult. And as you said, you know, you have to walk the line between being able to run your business and being able to protect your data. That's a very difficult thing.
Yeah, there's no perfect solution. I mean, if you want zero risk, don't operate a business.
Right.
You know, and, you know, the way I would approach this is there are very effective tools that catalog and audit all access to all data if you deploy it properly and you can find all your data, which is, you know, a tremendous problem for large organizations. You know, and you could architect in a way where even the admins couldn't necessarily some admins couldn't necessarily get around this, and you'd have to split duties and all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, again, it comes back to cost. There are methodologies, but does the cost make sense to your organization?
Exactly.
Both culturally, efficiency gains or losses, cost of acquisition, cost of operation.
Especially a lot of those kinds of technologies take a lot of management overhead.
Yeah. And if you're doing it right, those guys who are running that gear aren't the guys who also have admin rights to anything else.
That's right.
So you're doubling up on staff. You know, so it's not a hopeless situation in any means. It's merely this is one more threat vector. Is it a viable threat to your organization? Do you want to solve it to a certain level? What are you willing to mitigate it to? How much are you willing to invest to mitigate it to a certain level?
Right. And that's going to be very situational to each business. So like you said before, security is very local.
Yes. It's like real estate. It's all local. You know, this is like a big debate I used to have, Jerry and I, way back in the day. We worked for a company that had a managed services department that ran firewalls and IPS and that sort of stuff for customers. And the executives at the company wanted the IT organization's devices to be run by the managed services organization, you know, eat your own dog food. And we had big, big debates in the organization over and over again if that was wise or not. And, you know, does it make sense? Do you want somebody who is politically connected to your organization, who is not in an IT department, you know, for instance, a SOC technician, having similar abilities as your IT organization for your own company? When it's another company, it's a whole different equation, right? But does it make sense to have your own managed services group in your own organization that's built to run external organizations' gear, run an internal gear? And that, I think there's arguments to be made on both sides. I know I'm completely taking this off topic, but I think there's a good debate to be had on both sides. My view, I think good separation of duties would dictate that eating your own dog food can go too far.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, you know, there's probably some separation of duty arguments to be made that it does make sense. But, you know, in my experience, a lot of times you, especially lately, you know, when you get into the situation of having to run investigations and taking complicated actions, when you farm things out like that, it especially, you know, maybe to another department in your own group. I think it's different, as you said, if you've engaged a third party company, it's a lot simpler. But, you know, if you need to start monitoring the activity of, you know, of Joe and Joe sit next to Brian and you're trying to monitor what the heck's going on with Brian, that's a tough thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing about this article, and then we'll move on, is, you know, somehow this article focused on BYOD being, you know, hurt. You know, the BYOD thing is interesting. I've got some thoughts on it. Maybe we'll talk about it on another show, but again, it comes back down to your data, right? Controlling your data. And if your company needs to have the access to data that is convenient enough, fast enough, and, you know, that dictates mobile devices with that data, that's a risk you take. And that risk might be worth it. There is no yes to BYOD or no to BYOD. You know, that risk might be worth it. And then there are tools out there. So, you know, it's a slowly maturing space. It's still got some work to do. That you can, but, you know, certain organizations may never allow employee-owned devices to touch their data. Other organizations, it's a godsend. So, you know, again, it's this whole one-size-fits-all of some of these articles drive me a little crazy because it's not that simple.
Yep. And I would also add that if you think simply cutting off BYOD, and there is a slight implication here in this article, if you restrict BYOD and people's ability to use their own iPad or laptop or USB drive, and that is, you know, a material improvement in the likelihood of your data being taken or disclosed in this kind of a scenario, I think you're mistaken.
Yeah, I think the appropriate move here is a CIO or CISO or whomever is, you know, in charge of this decision, or at least in charge of explaining the decision, should quantify the benefits and costs, right?
Yes.
And really, executive management should make that decision of what risk they're willing to accept for the benefits.
Right.
Like anything, right? You know, it's almost like a lawyer advising a company on, you know, you can do X, Y, and Z, but A, B, and C is likely to result. It's your decision.
Right. And I can tell you there is another angle to BYOD, you know, which is not necessarily security related, and that is, you know, the reduction in capital outlay. You know, one thing that a lot of business leaders have come to realize is that people like to replace their devices a whole lot more frequently than companies are willing to pay for. And they've also figured out that most people, at least in the developed world, are willing to go out and buy their own computer.
Yeah.
Or iPad or what have you. And so I think it's fairly attractive from a budget standpoint to let people do that. And, you know, if you're a very large company and, you know, you've got, you know, 100,000 people or so, that could really add up to some significant money. And you have to think pretty hard about, you know, how many times are you likely to realize, you know, some kind of a loss as a result of allowing these devices versus what it would cost you to continue providing them. And it's always a business decision.
It is. I do think I could, I don't know, sort of project or I'm guessing there might eventually be a backlash, though. You know, at some point, you're going to have a certain number of these devices of either the entire device or the container for the corporate data get wiped for whatever reason. Or you're going to get something, you know, akin to a really advanced piece of malware where in a desktop or laptop world, we would nuke and pave, reformat and rebuild that box before we trusted it again. You know, what happens when that happens to an employee-owned device? And they're like, the heck with this. You know, if you're going to do that to my device, you get to pay for it, and I'm not letting you touch my personal device again. So I could see a certain level of backlash, you know, coming back at companies when they start employing some of these BYOD tools and doing the right thing, quote unquote, when something happens and trying to protect their data. It's not all rosy. There's a downside here of when you're trying to control that data, and I wouldn't be surprised if eventually that starts to bite them. We'll see.
Absolutely. I think you're right. And, you know, additionally, in my experience, there's a lot of jurisdictional problems, especially in other countries, where you're restricted as to, you know, how much control you can have as a, you know, as a an employer over a device that's not owned by the company.
Yeah.
And so.
So, you know, I could see email always being there, but, you know, I could also see them starting to limit other stuff.
Yes.
You know, and there's a great advantage, right? You know, if we see all these reports lately of at least U.S. workers never turn off, right? They're always on work email because it's on their phone and they're sitting there on a Saturday night, you know, doing whatever they're doing, and they're doing work email. And companies realize a benefit from that, you know, unless the employee's drunk at the time, but that's a different story. You know, but this is why I personally, and, you know, sometimes my employers frown at this, I actually have two different cell phones. I have a work cell phone and a personal cell phone, in part because I want to unplug unless it's something really, really vital. I need that downtime. I need to de-stress. Otherwise, I get worked up on stuff I see on a weekend, and it didn't, you know, it was causing me too much stress.
Yeah. I can understand that. I'm kind of the opposite. I have work email on my personal iPhone, and I never get to unplug.
So see?
I can understand.
That's why you've lost your hair.
It is. You're right. Absolutely. Had nothing to do with working with you.
Well, you know,
I'm not going to point out that when we started working together, I had hair, and by the end, I was bald.
That's true. That's true. You also didn't have kids when we started working together. Ooh. And then you did.
Well, you know what? Let's move on. I don't want to talk about that anymore.
That'll be point to Callet. For those keeping score at home.
All right. The next story, millions stolen from U.S. banks. And this is an interesting story for a couple of reasons. Number one is, it points out an interesting strategy being adopted by some of these online criminals, where in my mind, I characterize it as similar to the group of people walking into the store, and, you know, some people distract the cashiers and people while somebody else is off stealing things. And so what happened here apparently is, there's this wire transfer switch, right? And apparently it's a private network, not exposed to the internet and all that happy stuff. And apparently somebody figured out how to get in and start making fraudulent transactions across this switch. But not only were they doing that, they were also doing a denial of service against it. And so that's kind of interesting because it's not exposed to the internet. And so the idea here is, you know, you're slipping through fraudulent transactions, and at the same time, you're giving the security people something loud and noisy to go and chase while your transactions have a chance to clear.
Well, this is classic military tactic from the beginning of time. Feint an attack to distract your enemy, and then the other attack is someplace else. And, you know, this is just a lack of maturity and sophistication on the part of we defenders. You know, something happens and we assume that that's the only thing happening, and we put all of our resources on it, and shame on us. You know, and I think what this is teaching us is, hey, when something's going down, put 75% of your staff on it, keep 25% back to watch for something else.
Yes.
You know, and understand that could be somebody jiggling that doorknob to get you to go to that door while they're breaking in the window. And that's, you know, it's not trying to dumb this down, but that's exactly what was going on here. And it's basic common sense when it comes to any sort of, military operation. And yet we have to relearn this lesson in the InfoSec community, apparently.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and say these guys, somebody here got owned, their computer got owned, and they got some kind of remote access Trojan dropped, probably by being phished. And, you know, their computer's connected to the internet because, hey, everybody has to check Facebook while they're working, right? And, you know, that let the bad guys have a avenue into this private payment switch network.
Jerry, why do you hate Facebook?
Well, I mean, it's Facebook, Twitter. I hate them all.
My apologies in the background. My info security cat just walked in, and he apparently wants to contribute to the program. In fact, he's now jumped on my desk and is sniffing the microphone. This could get interesting. Uh-oh. This could be catastrophic, no pun intended, to the entire podcast.
The hair. Oh, my God.
All right. Right. He is. Yes. Anyway, moving on. Sorry, I got distracted by the cat. Yes, it is. It is one of those things where, you know, we've seen this before where, you know, they tried to either down the website too. This happened a couple of months ago, I remember. They moved a bunch of money out of a bank account, and then they built a fake website for the website, you know, that they would log into, redirected by the piece of malware sitting on the box to represent the money was still there. And this is almost like it reminds me of you know, magic, and I mean illusions.
Yes, absolutely.
Why are you trusting certain assumptions? And this is human nature, right? We all do this, and the bad guys know this, right? But, you know, you look at, I don't know if you've ever watched anything about a guy named Apollo Robbins, but he's a brilliant illusionist and pickpocketer, and what he calls himself is a deception specialist. And he's all about the ways that the human brain assumes things and using that against people. Now, in his case, he does it for entertainment. But the bad guys use it all the time. So, you know, and I think this is part of what makes information security defense of people so weird is we almost have to train our brain to challenge all of these sorts of built-in shortcuts that our brain does to make sure that we're not allowing ourselves as best we possibly can, which is very difficult, to just buy into all these assumptions, right? So how do you know? You know, you trust this website. Why do you trust that website? What if this happens? And mind, you can get extremely paranoid about this, right? But if it really, really, really matters to you, it's like two-factor authentication. Give me two factors of reliability on something I care about, as well as not getting all my guys distracted by a DDoS when other stuff's going on, right? You know, and you could do that with tools. You can do that with automation. You can do it with procedure. But I really feel like in many ways, this is stuff that, for instance, the military has gotten extremely good at building process and procedure around of not committing all the resources to a, you know, what could be a diversionary attack and all sort of stuff. And we in the information security community could really learn a lot from that by just sort of realizing that it's not as simple as just one problem at a time.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
I know I just went on a long monologue there. And
well, you know, the other thing that I harp on a lot is certainly what you said makes a lot of sense. And in the context of a bank, you know, I know generally banks have distinct fraudulent, you know, anti-fraud teams from information security teams. And, you know, I don't know what happened in this case. To me, it seems like a DDoS wouldn't have distracted the anti-fraud team, but, you know, I don't know. There's really not a lot of detail here, but, you know, I guess the point is in this particular case, the security guys were off trying to figure out what's going on with the DDoS. Meanwhile, somebody in the organization's computer was probably owned and, you know, being the source of these transactions.
Yeah, I mean,
and not being paid attention to.
It's interesting too because, you know, according to the article, $200 piece of crimeware, you know, to launch the DDoS attacks, while they were doing fraudulent ACH transfers from between 180,000 to 2.1 million. That's pretty healthy ROI.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we're on the wrong side of this. I don't know. I'm kidding. NSA, just kidding.
They'll be by to interview tomorrow.
Echelon bomb, nuclear president.
Oh, man. And here we go. All right, enough on that one. We'll move to the last story. And this one is titled, "The CISO Shouldn't Be the Defender of Security." And this came from a Gartner vice president named Paul Proctor. And apparently he was giving a presentation at a conference somewhere. And there was one particular quote that I highlighted, and I'll read it right now. "Choosing to save money and experience more risk is a legitimate business decision. The failure is allowing executives to live there without it being a conscious choice." And what he's trying to say is that CISOs or CSOs or whatever tend to take this superhero responsibility for protecting the organization. And what they fail to do is kind of share the responsibility around to the other executives in the organization. And that creates a problem because at its core, just like we've been talking about the entire podcast, security is a series of business decisions. How much money do you want to invest? How much risk is your organization willing to tolerate? How much is your data, whatever it is, worth to you?
Yeah, I 100% agree with this article. I think this is a brilliant point. You know, this is akin to going to the CFO and saying, "We need $2 million for expansion." And the CFO coming back with, "Well, we could borrow the money. We could." And then, no, we don't want the details. Just give us $2 million. Well, there are choices. We don't care. You figure them out. Right? That's not how business works.
Right.
You know, at certain levels. And I 100% agree that the CISO's job and the CIO's job is to, you know, keep the weed, don't get down in the weeds, right? But at the end of the day, at a business language level, communicate to the rest of the leadership team, these are the trade-offs, right? And understand that these are the risks that we're incurring. This is what I think can mitigate that risk to this level. What are you comfortable with? And make sure that they all buy off on that. Now, this is assuming a fully functional, non-dysfunctional management team that can actually operate with unity. But I do believe that CISOs are not communicating well in general, right? The general statement, at a business language level. And that businesses, even though we've had IT for 40 years now in general, haven't yet sort of assumed this role of they need to be involved in these decisions, right? They just sort of, it's like they try to outsource all of this to the CISO and the IT department. And at the end of the day, it is a business decision to how much you spend on security and what you secure.
And from the perspective of the board and upper management, if you, you know, no matter how underfunded you are, as they point out in the article, you know, if you don't experience a significant amount of problems, if you're not composing your message in terms of business risk, you know, as he points out, how many lost cars are we at risk of losing because of downtime? You know, what basically the message that you're bringing forward is, you know what, we didn't have a problem last year, but oh my God, everything's going to hell. And I need, you know, $2 million to buy lots of new stuff. And all they're seeing is, well, you didn't really have any problems last year. You know, why can't you just get by another year with what we gave you last year?
Yeah, I get that. And I think it's a naive viewpoint, though, because why do we buy insurance, right? If I buy fire and casualty insurance on my business, and even though I didn't have a fire last year, it doesn't mean that wasn't a worthwhile investment,
well,
right? I'm mitigating that risk.
But I think that the point that's being made here is that CISOs are not doing a good job of equating security with insurance, right?
Yeah.
And so you know, I think the point of the article here is that in the minds of these board members, they've kind of compartmentalized IT and security as kind of like a necessary evil, and not, as you said, like insurance. It's not a business risk mitigation function. It's something that some whiny people come to us and ask for more money for every year.
Are you saying we're whiny?
Well, I'm not whiny, and I know you're not whiny.
Depends on who you ask, but it's an interesting, and I think it's a mindset issue, right? I think in some ways, it's a business maturity thing too. It's like we're treating security the same way we treat IT desktop acquisition, completely different.
Right. Get your cat under control.
Yeah, sorry about that. Apparently not. He wants to be on the show. Clearly.
It's okay. Thor has been on the show. It's all right.
Well, we'll have the Thor and Caesar after show.
There we go.
And you know, that will be included with cat videos. I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep going. So anything else to say about the story? I think it's an excellent read, and I highly encourage everybody to go and find it in the show notes and read it. It's not very long, definitely worth reading.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Anything else? This is the end, last story. Anything else you want to talk about?
Not that's really burning. I think it'll be an interesting week. At least down in the Southeast, a lot of IT folks are also into nerdy type things, and we've got Dragon Con coming up. So the bad guys might have a field day over Labor Day weekend, since lightly staffed in IT. We'll see.
That's right.
But
watch your firewalls, people. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, one thing I wanted to mention, and I know I didn't give you a heads up on this. There is a I don't know if you're familiar with the Down the Rabbit Hole podcast.
No.
It's hosted by a guy named Raf, who works at HP. Generally, I'm not a big fan of it, but he had Rob Graham on
it. Wow, did you just slam his podcast?
Not really.
Are you trying to cause controversy? Are you trying to cause like a podcast, like mortal enemy that we're going to have to there's going to be a grudge match now?
Oh, man.
You're just trying to generate news.
Whatever it takes.
All right.
Anyway, he had Rob Graham on, which, which was an interesting discussion. They talked a lot about defense in depth. And I just wanted to mention it here because I think it's really worth everybody going and listening to that. I thought it was a really good episode. You know, I don't agree with everything that was said, but it really gets your gears turning when you listen to it. And that's what my hope is for this podcast, right? Just get people thinking.
Yeah, I have not heard it, but I know Rob, not well, but and I think he's brilliant. If you're not following him on Twitter and you're not reading his occasional blog posts, I think you're missing out. I don't follow a ton of people because sometimes it becomes an echo chamber, but I think Rob has a very interesting viewpoint that sometimes is different than a lot of folks. And I always learn stuff from reading Rob's stuff, and I would recommend Rob. So yeah, I'll have to go track that down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. He's really interesting to read. So with that, we're calling this another week. Thank you much, Mr. Callett.
Thank you, Mr. Bell, and have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Likewise. And thank you everyone for listening. This was episode 32. You can find the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. If you have any comments, especially, on my choice of co-hosts, send me an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. You can follow the podcast at DefensiveSec. You can follow me at MaliciousLink. You can follow Mr. Callett at Lurg. And with that, I wish you well. Have a great week. Bye.